I'd like to introduce, although she really needs no introduction, Tessa Davis, who is a consultant in paediatric emergency medicine at Royal London Hospital. And we all know her as co-founder of Don't Forget the Bubbles. And Tessa is joined by Shawnee Nagel. Shawnee is a mother of four vivacious and charismatic children. And Shawnee is going to be sharing her challenging and difficult experience of her daughter's illness for our learning. So thank you very much.
Let's go.
You okay?
Hiya.
You good? Okay.
I need cards, she doesn't. Okay.
This is Shawnee and Libby's story. I am an observer, a friend, a healthcare professional. I'm happy to say that it is a story that ends well. I was in a situation any of you could find yourselves in, a neighbour, a colleague, a relative with a sick child. Should you wade in or not? And if you do, what is your role? Are you there as a friend or as a clinician? Where does the line lie, and how do you know when you've crossed it? Imagine you were me. What would you do as the story unfolds?
Libby was our princess after three boys.
By the age of three, she had the most gorgeous long blonde curls. She's one of those kids that people stopped us in the street all the time to tell us how magnificent she was. I'm not biased. Libby always returned the compliment by pulling a funny face. One day, she wasn't herself under the weather. She actually didn't even want to go to the park, which was totally out of character. She still wasn't feeling herself a few days later, and a friend of mine who's a medic didn't like the look of her either and suggested we take her for a scan. So the next day, off to the x-ray place and having trouble holding Libby still, she wriggles around on the table. I call my husband in a little bit of stress. She's probably got appendicitis. He happens to be nearby, which is quite uncommon, actually. So he pops in and helps me hold her down. The chief radiographer of the clinic actually gets called in and starts scanning, and some panicked looks start to exchange. He ushers us out of the scanning room and says, "Your life is about to turn upside down. Your daughter has a tumour and you need to go straight to Sydney Kids Hospital." There was no hesitation in his voice, no ifs, no buts. And I can't remember a lot of the detail of that conversation, except for that key phrase. What won't ever leave me, though, is that innate panic and gut-wrenching turn that I felt, along with the knowledge that our lives would never again be the same. She's 3 years old, yesterday literally playing in the park, and today being rushed off to emergency, people coming in, poking, prodding her, talking quietly to one another. I don't know what's going through her head. I don't even know what's going through my own. One day normal, the next day, we'll see.
Shawnee and I had known each other for a few years. Our kids were the same age, they went to the same schools, we had the same circle of friends. We weren't besties, but we were friends. But the coincidence of all of this happening in the place where I worked, it threw us together. I don't remember Shawnee asking me to be that person. I think I just pushed myself to do it. It seemed like the right thing to do. I was in the right place at the right time. That first evening in the hospital, I couldn't tell if my presence with them on the ward was a comfort or an intrusion, and I angsted over how long to stay and when I should leave.
We were highly emotional by this point, and we couldn't handle being around other emotional people. My family at the hospital was not what we needed right now. Tess seemed like the obvious choice to take along. She was a professional and invested as a friend, and she had all the knowledge we needed to take along with us. She was the obvious choice. Shock sets in. My life ends up on a roller coaster, and I don't know who's taking care of my three boys, getting them to school, feeding them, getting them dressed, loving them. Our friends stepped up, and you have no idea. They literally took control of our lives and saved us. And I can tell you that as a total control freak, learning to let go was one of those challenges that I had to face and a skill that I had to acquire.
It was biopsy results day, and the meeting was 3 p.m. on the oncology day unit. I was on a shift in the ED, and my consultant kindly let me go. Josh, Shawnee, and I stood in the hospital corridor, and we waited for the oncology team to appear. My stomach was churning. I know what it's like on the other side. I know how easily 5 minutes can turn into 30 minutes when you're trying to finish jobs from a ward round. Or maybe there was another family who were being given worse news than we were waiting for at that time. But the waiting was excruciating. After 2 grueling hours, the team finally arrived and we were ushered into that room. I could feel my heart racing. I'd just done an oncology job as a peds trainee in the hospital. I'd been in that room with that same consultant and that social worker delivering bad news. But those times, I was the one perched on the table uncomfortably in the corner writing in the notes. Now I find myself on the couch next to my friends talking about Libby. This was not what I had been trained for. I was there as the news was thrown at them. It was a neuroblastoma. It was stage 4. I had gone from novice to expert overnight, able to recall stats off the top of my head. A neuroblastoma is a cancer derived from nervous tissue, predominantly in the adrenal glands. And I knew from my recent frantic research that stage 4 meant that the cancer had metastasized, and it meant that Libby had a 40% chance of 5-year survival. I stared at the reg who was in the corner, and she continued scribbling furiously in the notes, and she refused to make eye contact with me. I looked at my friends. I thought of all the chemo, the side effects, the sepsis. They were absolutely shattered, but all I could think about was that actually they had no idea how much worse it was likely to get.
Waiting was the hardest part. Not treating the monster ravaging Libby's body. She looked so healthy. The doctor told us the news. It was bad, stage 4. And the full protocol was going to happen. This wasn't an option. We weren't given a choice. Papers were slid in front of us, release forms. These are for the studies. These are for the transfusions. These are for the risks. I'm just sitting there signing. Everything on that day was a blur. And there was so much information coming at us, it was such a comfort to have Tess there on the couch by our side to be our ears. Libby's treatment started with 4 rounds of chemotherapy to reduce the tumour to a size where it could be resected, and then another 4 rounds of chemo. Off to radiation, 17 rounds. And all we could think was what are we doing to our child? How could we do this to our child? But then again, how could we not? She lost those beautiful curls, and it was quite a traumatic event, actually, so much so that once she was bald, it was actually a relief for us. And so we can only go with what made her comfortable, and that's what it was. So, Your Honour.
Libby enjoyed getting some photos with people. She had a good sense of humour, and she made sure she took photos with every bald man that she came across. As a full-time peds trainee, I was in the hospital most days, and I stopped by to see Shawnee and Libby after each shift. I tried to think of ways to diffuse the seriousness of it all. One evening after I'd finished a shift at work, myself and a friend snuck in a bottle of wine and a corkscrew into the oncology ward, and we enjoyed a glass or two in the cubicle with Shawnee and had a laugh. Shawnee is the rule breaker. I am not. This serious act of alcohol smuggling in my place of work is pretty much the riskiest thing I've ever done in my life.
Stem cell transplant followed, which meant off to isolation for a couple of months. Heavy bouts of chemotherapy to clear out her bone marrow to make way for the freshly laundered cells to be popped back in. She became so ill, it was heartbreaking for us to watch. And she'd lost so much weight that it was required she would have 2 daily weigh-ins. And if you knew Libby, being told what to do, especially multiple times a day, it wasn't her thing. And she insisted that I weigh in with her. And I can tell you that we definitely had giggles from my sister as we both watched my weight steadily climb. Yeah. But Libby was a trooper. She was. She was amazing. And she learned to play by herself. She did yoga sessions and she played and she discovered her artistic flair in isolation. And I can tell you her most recent painting just sold for $35,000. what she did was amazing. And one of her best pastimes was dressing up as Elsa, her favorite character, and belting out "Let It Go" from the top of her lungs. I find it hard enough to laugh, sorry. Tess would come in after every shift. It didn't matter what time she finished, she was there. I was always awake, and it always was so comforting to know that she'd be turning up. Libby made it home from isolation for her 4th birthday, and we surprised her in home isolation, because she wasn't allowed out in public yet, with a ballet lesson, a private lesson. And dance has continued to be one of the things that have really, really gotten her through the challenging times in her life. The ringing of the bell ceremony is a ceremony that we'd watched so many times from the sidelines. And it symbolises, besides the end of treatment, which is what it indicated, it symbolised hope, courage and longevity for me. A new beginning for one of the little kids, one of the little battlers who had finished treatment. And now it was our turn, finally. It was the hype and emotional charge that we thought it would be. Our friends and family came into the hospital, Tess tuned in from across the seas, and we danced and we sang, and Libby rang that bloody bell, and we were all there ringing it with her.
Libby had made it to the end of her treatment. I was back and living in the UK, but as a peds doc, I'd watched many children reach this landmark, and I was so excited for them. I set my alarm to wake me up in the middle of the night in London, and I snuck downstairs in the dark while my family was asleep. Shawnee set me up on FaceTime, and I watched Libby ring that bell while everyone danced and sung around her. They had done it. We had done it.
We'd been home for 2 weeks. I'm driving home, felt so normal. My phone rings. Pull over to answer it. It's the doctor on the phone. This isn't the phone call I wanted to be making to you. Libby has a brain tumour. I open my car door. I throw up all over the road.
I had no idea what to say when Shawnee called to tell me this news. How could this have happened and how could it have happened so quickly? We knew there was a high risk of relapse, but they had only had a couple of weeks since ringing the bell.
Last time, we were so blissfully unaware of what was going to happen. This time we knew, and it was time to meet with the doctors. I also had some insight now that I could play an integral part of the medical team treating my daughter. I could advocate for her. I could influence, in some small way, the the way treatment was given, whether it be, you know, asking about a different administration time for medication so she wasn't disturbed in the middle of the night, which would so often she'd wake up to hysterically, or whether it would be leaving a cannula in her leg to avoid daily needle jabs and two of us pinning her down. These small choices and changes can make such a difference for the treatment of a child and the ease with which it goes. A CNS relapse, central nervous system relapse, is a rare occurrence and most likely incurable. Some of the doctors actually even suggested that we take her home and enjoy what little time we have left. No options? Not an option. I needed to fix this, and I was going to fix this.
Shawnee sent me research articles daily. Is this a good paper, Tess? As a friend and as a medic, I knew my views were likely to be taken seriously. But I'm not an oncologist. And even the oncologists, they were looking through the evidence-based research trials, new therapies, and they weren't sure what to do. Shawnee's team in Australia were out of treatment options there and tried to help her find something overseas. I did my best to support Shawnee where I could, without overstepping the mark in an area where I was clearly no expert. But was my support just giving Shawnee false hope? Or was there really a chance that there was something out there that could help?
Research is not my forte at all. I am no academic. I struggled through school, high school, university. But I was motivated, and I had to learn, and I had to learn quickly, and I became a pro. I found a study, and we pinned her life and ours on a 10-year-old study, which we found, done on only 21 children, available at an exorbitant cost that neither us nor most could afford, available only in the United States. But we were going to try to do everything we could to save our little girl. With the tumour now resected, we knew we were just buying time. There were no survivors of neuroblastoma CNS relapse. So within a week, I think, of finding the study, Libby and I were on a plane to New York. And within 24 hours of, I mean, besides the fact we'd left everything we knew behind and friends, family, network, within 24 hours of landing, Libby started a very intensive 21-day radiation protocol, which she had to go under general anesthetic for, often awaking from so aggressively that they popped her back to sleep again. That gave me time, though. I got to set up a life for my boys for when they'd arrive a couple months later. One of the highlights of for Libby being on the cancer ward was meeting kids that were like her. It gave her such a confidence. She wasn't different. And one of the downsides also meant meeting kids on a cancer ward was actually learning a lesson all too soon for a little girl about losing somebody that you care about. Libby lost one of her friends only 3 months after we arrived. Audrey had just turned 3. She was angry at me for telling her, actually. I ended up creating an alternate reality for her where Audrey was happy and healthy, being looked after by her grandparents, and even inherited a dog when my sister's puppy passed away. It really brought her great comfort. Libs was now ready for treatment that we, you know, moved across the world for, and it revolved around a radioactive antibody being inserted into the spinal fluid. And at the beginning of this, they give a small test dose. However, within a couple of weeks of this test dose going in, Libby's platelets bottom out. Zero. Nada. Okay. The doctors are like, well, we don't know what caused that. That's never happened before. So they don't know what to do with her. They do know, however, what they can't do, and that is to continue with the treatment we just moved across the world for. But how was she going to survive? I mean, this is a CNS relapse. She needed the treatment. But here we are. 4 years since diagnosis, 2.5 years since her relapse, and 18 months since her platelets bottomed out. Libby is at school. She's learning to read. She's got a great social group. She's popular as anything. And we couldn't be happier.
Being a friend and a healthcare professional in a situation like this, it isn't easy. I don't know if I did the right thing here or not, but I don't regret trying. It's made me a better clinician and a better friend. So when you find yourself in a situation like this, remember that yes, you are a clinician, but more importantly, you are a friend, and sometimes a friend who understands the clinical situation is exactly what's needed. So when your turn comes, step forward.
Libby, we are so proud of you and all you have achieved against the odds which were stacked against you.